Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Ben Marcus, the author, most recently, of a novel, Notable American Women, published by Vintage as a paperback original. He's the author, as well, of The Age of Wire and String, which were called Stories, published by Donkey Archive, and recently come out from an art press. Is a collaboration with Matthew Ritchie called The Father Costume, and that was published by
ArtSpace Books.
Yeah, brand new. And I wanted to begin by examining a whole bunch of ideas about writing that aren't very common. And the first I want to talk to you about is the subject of self-revulsion. It seems like it's something you've inherited in a way from Michelle Larrie's book, Manhood. And I wondered, first of all, about that, because it seems to run through the work from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think that I'm more comfortable with modest personas in fiction that, when turned extreme, turn on themselves. And as I've started to use my name and fake an autobiographical stance with my characters, I have uncovered more self-loathing than I had thought was in me. And it seems worth exploring for me. It seems that there's quite a bit of subject matter, and it opens up rather than shuts down. And I've had a harder time with characters who seem to know what they think and be comfortable with themselves and be happy. That seems to have narrower possibilities for me. So in some sense, the self-revulsion is something I draw on from my life. And in another sense, there's an artifice and an expansiveness to it that I'm drawn to.
Well, for all of the differences, it's possible to look at all this work as an ongoing autobiographical essay placed or set in the context of an imaginary or post-real world. And that sense of a self that discovers itself to be more and more oppressed, miserable, and that misery, as the books emerge, turns out to have been the plan of the hypothetical parents who have conceived childhood as an ongoing behavioral experiment or fraternity hazing, and seem to be interested in torturing the child so he'll have adequate levels of melancholy and fear to make him a good adult.
Yeah, or even no levels of melancholy and fear. The parents in the book seem to fantasize about a state of personhood devoid of feeling. And as parents, they've designated themselves as the creators of this kid. And they have different theories about what a person should be. And I was interested in that kind of control that parents have, and to, instead of seeing it as a benevolent practice, see it more as a theoretical, philosophical pursuit, that here we have this kid, and we can tell him anything we want, and we can make him wear equipment and completely treat him like a lab rat. And they seem to think that feelings have not ever turned out for the best for anyone, that feelings have proved to be a distraction and a setback. So it's a vision of progress that's, I think, dystopic and hurtful. But I don't know that they want consciously to make him miserable.
But it seems as if whatever has been induced has become at least the feeling tone of the books, all of them, as they go on. And it seems as if the spectrum or the balance is something like hyperactive imagination balanced by depression.
Yeah.
So that they're, that no matter how wild and extravagant the possibilities and the world becomes, the enunciation of this world is through the depressed and leveled sensibility.
Well, I wonder if I wasn't seeking ballast for hyper-imaginative writing. When I was first writing, the kind of criticism I heard often was, sure, great, that's a fancy imagination, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't have any heart. And this, to me, I took very personally. I thought that this was the worst kind of failure, to write something that didn't have emotion or heart in it, whatever that's really supposed to mean. On the other hand, I also was very afraid of sentimentality or anything approaching autobiography. And in college, I read Donald Barthelme, who to me seemed to suggest I could make it all up. Yet, of course, what was great about Barthelme was how sad those made-up stories were. I bought myself a little school. Just these preposterous, absurdist premises that led to a really deep sweetness and irony. So I think I was always torn between the place of just really accelerated, intense imagination, but then something very plain and sorrowful. And I've always wrestled with how to try to do both. Some of my best memories of books are the ones that I fought with, that I didn't want to finish reading, like Correction by Thomas Bernhard, which now, for me, is just the most astounding book. Yet, it took me forever to read it. I just thought, well, it's repetitious, it's narcissistic, it's not going anywhere, and yet it did. So now I don't just remember the book, but I remember my relationship to the book. The complex way that I fought it, and that's important to me.
Now, it's hard to explain to someone who hasn't read this kind of book. By this kind of book, I might include Beckett, Gombrowicz, you name some.
Borges, Dean Koontz. Some of the unpublished Dean Koontz work. I think of Borges, and sometimes that's to me a shorthand way to describe what I'm trying to do, to use non-fictional or documentary forms in service of fiction, maybe recognizing that any act of language has fictional aspects to it. And Borges revealed that you could write an essay that was incorrect, that seemed to traffic in just information. And the information was the fiction, not the characters and what they did, but the facts, the concepts. That was the pleasure and the invention and the imagination.
But can you say, in these books that make these excessive demands, like Correction, or my particular favorite of Bernhard is Extinction, but what is a reader reading for?
Well, I suppose there's an argument you enter into with a book, and to me, ideally, that argument doesn't want to end very quickly. That it touches you in the deepest way, and it asks the hardest things from you, and it puts you in touch with whatever is not resolved for you, which to me, I suppose, is a territory as a reader that I'd like spoken to. I don't want a demonstration of technique, and I don't want to be reminded of what I think I already know. I'd actually like to be put in mind of what I don't like to think about and what I don't know how to think about. And ideally, for me, a writer like Beckett does that, in that he enters that place of irresolution and creates a drama of what we don't know, a complication. He reiterates how complicated things are. And certainly there are many writers who try to do this, and it can become sticky, and it can become dull, and it can go wrong in millions of ways. And I think when I do it, it goes wrong, but I aspire to something of that kind. And then on the other hand, I feel so uncomfortable saying what a reader should get out of it. I think there's some etiquette I have against announcing that I could say. And the readers have to declare that for themselves. But I do know, I can speak for myself as a reader.
What I'm trying to suggest was, regardless of what you find in the books, the authors characteristically present a wall or a pane of glass to suggest to the reader almost, don't come here unless you're willing mm-hmm. to find things very different from the way you like them or expect them to be. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if in one of my favorite books, William Gass's The Tunnel, he spends 150 pages producing an impenetrable impasto in order to keep the wrong readers out, right. Literally so.
He's building a moat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And saying, you know, you want to get in?
Yeah.
You're going to have
working.
To really
earn your stripes.
But why? You know, you're a very young member of this tradition.
Well, and I wouldn't say, along with William Gass, that that's what I want. I think I feel, in a sense, so apologetic for what people might call the difficulty of what I'm doing, because I don't consciously want to repel anyone. I want to argue that it's worth reading and that actually there's immersion here. Some of what I write that I end up regretting the fastest is the arch self-conscious stuff that I can feel is a little played out and has been done to death in the 60s and as metafiction and now has been revived by other writers. So I don't consciously want there to be a wall. I guess I just don't know what other way to write. That I want to bring the world into existence, and so I need to give different characters voices, and I need to write manuals and manifestos and chronologies, and the form starts to seem necessary to me. And it also might just be a limitation I have in terms of that sort of story-driven narrative, because I feel capable of it in a small way, but I feel still to be very much an apprentice to that mode of writing.
Now, by the way, I'm speaking to Ben Marcus, author of Notable American Women, published by Vintage. One of the things that I wonder about is what kind of progress has been made in this kind of novel, which can be said to be in a peculiar way against progress. The virtues of these books that I think of include endlessness. However short they may be, they have a principle of endlessness about them. I think of your book, Notable American Women, and I think of Hebdomeros, the novel by
DiCurico.
They're very similar books. In a way. In that book, a teacup falls on the floor and stars rearrange themselves into the shape of the shattered pieces of the teacup, much in the way, in your book, that people talking so much, almost like the overuse of aerosol cans, cause the winds to rise, and people in these books are learning how to be quiet and not move so much so that they don't disturb the weather. But what do you sense? How does this kind of novel progress through its tradition? Do you have an idea about that?
I think one way is that what might seem fantastical and surreal and out of the world is possibly seeking a more of a domestic pursuit. And for me, in a way, writing about a family that's unhappy is the most obvious, typical subject matter for American fiction. If we did a concordance of all the books on the shelves of a big bookstore, the novels are about family. And maybe the better ones are about bad families. It's hard to think of books that concern themselves with happy families and end happily. And so maybe this sort of transgressive, innovative tradition is seeking to align itself with something very rooted and very, very almost pedestrian in scope. And to see what that collision might afford. And for me, it's I think in The Age of Wire and String, there's a kind of surrealism that seems unchallenging to me now. To simply make physics go wrong in fiction, to have, you know, people's heads fly off, and the sort of easy fantastical techniques, that doesn't seem to be enough. But obviously, in surrealism, as an art movement, when that first started happening, it seemed so liberating to not be bound by physics. And I guess the direction I see, at least for me, as being valuable is really a basic emotional concerns actually playing themselves out in this maybe kind of more obscure, abstract, formal tradition.
Now, in this book, Father is essentially buried in a field while nonsensical language is being poured on him. Mother is the successful executive administrator of, it seems, Jane Dark's theories about removing emotion.
Yeah.
And she is administering not only to a house full of women who believe in the removal of emotion, but she is training her son, Ben Marcus, my guest, in this effective removal of expression, motion.
Yeah.
By the end of the book, Jane is immobile.
Yeah.
It seems as if, yes, it's an unhappy family, to put it mildly, but fed into a kind of hamburger grinder, a machine that's going to take these materials, process them, and spew them out in some different form.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I did it that way. I think that the divided family was a powerful thing for me to pursue, and I don't know. I have trouble in a way with all the characters in the same room, because I just, there's something that seems so unnatural about it all, and I feel very self-conscious, and like I don't really like to write dialogue, and so boom, the father has to go underground and he just gets a monologue and then he's done with. So there's this sort of structural necessity to keep him out of the way. And in both cases, though, the father has a monologue where he rants against the Ben Marcus character, and then so does the mother. In both cases, it was liberating for me to think what my parents, if they were to say the worst about me, might say, or if I allowed my parents to be vitriolic and sort of demonically mean. That those two passages were the easiest to write, to imagine if these people who I need to love me more than any other two people in the world, I require their love, and without it would probably not be a person. If that love were to turn on itself and become a kind of hatred. So it's sort of like wishful thinking in reverse that generated those two acts of hate speech by the two parents. And that they bookend the book, Father at the beginning and Mother at the end. And then in a way, everything between those two things is just an attempt to kind of exacerbate that sense of urgency and conflict and craziness in the world.
Well, you've said in an essay that Dr. Seuss was the writer who first mobilized your attention.
Yeah.
And you know, the creation of a zany world, and where zaniness has been routinized as well, it's what you find everywhere and on every page.
Yeah.
Seems very much to be. Can you talk about Dr. Seuss?
Well, I like that in language we're not bound by physics. We can say things that can't happen. And to me, it's really exciting that language is the medium of a writer, because we're really limited just by grammar, and of course many writers are not even limited by grammar. And Dr. Seuss, very early on, when I listened to his stories, when they were read to me by my parents, took me to a world in my head that I just couldn't have otherwise accessed, and reminded me that all it was words on a page, that his sentences created a world that was completely impossible, but and this to me is really sad, could only exist in words. So he found a way to, in a way, remind us how boring our own world was, that reality could never compete in delight and amazement and fascination with what we're doing simply with words. And I just found that so exciting. And you know, even now, when I remember my childhood, I feel that what I'm really remembering are the books I read far more vividly than what happened to me and, you know, where I lived and what my house looked like.
You quote from Dr. Seuss almost an aesthetic, a statement of aesthetics. Oh, snow and rain are not enough. Oh, we must make some brand new stuff.
Yeah.
But what are some of the procedures for making brand new stuff?
Well, what's odd to me is it's actually very, very easy to just use language to make things that can't happen in the world. And language seems completely unconcerned with physics. You know, you can say the coffee cup raised up on its own accord. That instantly breaches physics. And, you know, it's not particularly interesting, but to me, what is interesting is the bias I encounter against what might be called a fantastical utterance, an utterance of language that is not bound by physics. And I had a teacher early on who said, well, Marcus, if you only stayed in the world, if you only kept it to the world, it would be great. And I just thought, well, you know, isn't that just saying, okay, you know, write with one hand behind your back? Isn't that saying, here's your medium, you're a writer, your medium is language, but all this stuff is off limits, don't do that. And that just bummed me out.
Well, but what interests me about We Must Make Some Brand New Stuff is not the new stuff, but the process of making it. That is to say, the writers in this tradition have had almost, as a rule, funny procedures for making new stuff. Rameau Roussel made a book entirely out of puns, so that when you read in French his work, you'd actually be reciting a poem by Victor Hugo, or at least a synopsis of a poem by Victor Hugo. Others, you know, have a procedure called the exquisite corpse.
Yeah.
The Ulipians, so-called, have N plus 7. I was once talking to Harry Matthews about you, and he said, I admire his algorithm.
the highest compliment from Harry.
It's very simple, actually. He was willing to tell me. But what are the procedures for you for making brand new stuff?
Well, it is funny because when my first book came out, Harry Matthews wrote me and said, what was your method? And I'd never really been asked that. And what's interesting to me is that we have the vision of the writer in the attic just kind of clenching and coming up with an idea. But then, of course, there are these traditions of people who are willing to say, well, this is how I did it. You know, I unfolded a newspaper, or I made a hat, and then I read the words around the rim, and then that became my idea for a story. And I, with the first book, The Age of Wire and String, one thing I did was I read something that was very potent to me. It was the Folk Motif Index by a writer named Stith Thompson, who essentially culled motifs from every folk tale, fairy tale that he could get his hands on. And it's a multiple volume set. So some of the stories in that book, like Intercourse with Resuscitated Wife, I think that phrase exactly is just from Stith Thompson's index. And you can then go look up a story where someone has sex with a wife who's dead. And it might be a minor aspect of the fairy tale as a whole, but it's a motif. And this became my source book. And I just would They would give me an image, and I would just essentially try to create a little story lit around them. Another thing I did was read in the encyclopedia, and as I was talking about earlier, deliberately misread it. So I'd read a couple sentences, possibly transcribe them, and then continue. And this was a way of exerting control over what I read so that I became the writer of it, and I could finish it the way I wanted to. It's just sort of a revisioning of texts that are already in the world and saying, no, this is how it should be. Listen to it my way. So it's like sampling a little bit, sampling from what's out there. And I really have stopped doing any overt technique like that. And now it's a sort of old-fashioned grunting labor. but it sometimes involves a conscious thing, like, say, inverting my family story. My family story is one of warm, loving parents where everyone's emotions mattered and everyone talked constantly and argued constantly in a friendly way. So I consciously invert that. Emotions are not allowed and silence must be the mode. So that's a sort of conceptual choice, decision, idea that then gets put into play into a narrative. And that's maybe one rote programmatic thing I might do.
The other seems to be to say essentially that things, we are in the post-human age,
yeah,
and therefore things are much more interesting than the people who use them.
Yeah, yeah.
So this makes
or people are like things. And another thing I like to do, or I'm trying to do more of, is it's hard to describe it. I tried to do it in the book, The Father Costume. It's to essentially say things that can't really have any meaning but seem to. So there's I think a sentence where it says, the boat going over the water made a low English sound. And I really like that because just grammatically, we think that that makes a kind of sense. And when we have our little second to think about what an English sound is, there's no such thing, really. Yet it might have an associative property for somebody. So it's like hiding a joke in plain sight, but attempting to give it some strange mystery. So I like working in a simple grammar like that. And I guess using adjectives in a way that they can't really be used, or using things for adjectives in the wrong places. And that's become a kind of suggestive thing for me. And it's not the best example of it, but that's something I'm interested in now.
I've been speaking with Ben Marcus, author most recently of Notable American Women, published in a paperback original by Vintage, two other books, The Age of Wire and String, published in paper by Dalkey Archive Press, and The Father Costume. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of Notable American Women on the Bookworm webpage at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.